Hello there, you're listening to the Watson's Daily Podcast with me, Peter Watson, on Wednesday, the 23rd of November. Today, I am joined by Yasmin Husseini, who is a Watson's Daily Ambassador. Hi there, Yasmin. How are you doing today?
I'm good. A bit more sunny in London today. So
lovely. Always good. Always good. Always sunny in this room. Anyway, right. So what story stood out for you today in today's Watson's Daily?
Right. Today we have quite a lot to unpack. So my story is from the FT and is about ESG investing.
Yep.
Quite trendy topic.
Of course.
So, Amundi, which is Europe's largest fund manager, has declassified the majority of their $45 billion really green funds to sort of green.
Yes.
So they stated that the confusion over new EU sustainability rules and regulation has forced a change. The guidance of EU officials over the summer has failed to provide that the industry with a clear definition of sustainability. So it seems that they declassified their funds from Article 9 of the Europe Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation. Which is the highest sustainability designation under the regulation, to Article 8, which is more broad and, you know, less demanding threshold.
Yeah.
So why is that? What happened? So I think the main aim seems to avoid the accusation, obviously, of greenwashing and legal challenges down the road.
Yeah.
And other investment companies such as BlackRock, AXA, Invesco have also reclassified some of their funds from Article 9 to Article 8. So a bit less demanding. So what? So this highlights the complexity of ESG investing right now. And it's still not clear what counts as a sustainable place to put one's money.
Yeah.
And Amundi also probably has in mind that regulators do not want fund management groups labeling their funds as sustainable if they're not.
Yep.
Because obviously that has drastic consequences, such as the DWS German group, Asset Management, and Goldman Sachs have been accused of greenwashing this year. Goldman just yesterday had to pay a $4 million fine over this. So another important thing to know in this story is that sustainable fund assets are falling. I think this is due probably, obviously, to fossil fuels, oil and gas outperforming this year because of the energy crisis.
Yep.
So while it's true that pouring money into renewable energy stock is going to make it easier for companies to speed up the investment plans. So obviously, since the energy transition is inevitable at this rate, I think the question now is to what extent ESG investments can deliver high risk adjusted returns and help save the world in the process. And also, are we going to see, you know, more shades of green, like we talked about, you know, instead of just being gray and green, there's going to be sort of green, something that, you know,
greenish, kind of yellowy green, bluey green, you know. I agree. You know, I really agree with that. You know, this is a very interesting story. And I mean, I do think that ESG has always one of those things that everyone thinks they know what they're talking about, and they're like, oh yeah, this is really good, you know, for the environment, and this isn't, and it just isn't. It's a huge minefield. I think it's good that there is this kind of recognition that there are shades of green, you know, of greenness, because realistically, you can look at pretty much any company. And, you know, even you might think it's the greenest thing, and yet you can make it sound dirty.
Yes.
You know, it's very easy to do so. You just need to dig lower, deeper and deeper and deeper. The one that I always pick is Tesla, to illustrate this, because, you know, on the surface, you think, yes, it's absolutely green, electric vehicles, you know, emissions, a lot less, etc. But the problem is they're made in, you know, they're made in gigafactories. Gigafactories are made in the middle of nowhere, because that's where only where gigafactories can be made. You're cutting down forests, you're building roads, you're putting pipe, you know, you're putting utilities in. And then, and that's not even to mention the batteries that go into the cars, which are also very difficult to recycle. So all of these things, you know, it makes it very difficult. So I think that it's good there is a recognition of this. I think that it's understandable that investment managers are reclassifying their funds to the lower kind of bands, just because I suppose they want to make sure that they minimize any potential legal repercussions in the future. So I think that this is an interesting thing. It is something that we are going to see a lot more of as time goes on. And we had a chat before this Zoom call. I was saying then that the thing is with ESG, it is not new. It is not new. We've had this before. And I think that, say, for instance, in the early 2000s, even, it was called socially responsible investing and things like that. But it didn't really take off that much. But I think that over the last few years in particular, it has taken off to a very large extent. I actually think that the reason for that, and I don't know what, you know, again, maybe controversial, but I think the reason for that is because a lot of active investors have been almost kicked out of the market because of the rise of passive investing and money going towards passive funds. And I think that a lot of fund managers are trying to understandably justify their existence by saying, look, ESG is really complicated. You can't just invest that on an algorithm. You need someone actually looking at it. And this is, by the way, why we're charging more money to invest in these funds. So I think that there's a lot of that. And so because everyone is interested, because it sounds terrible, but because they want to justify their own job, suddenly this is actually a lot more of a big deal because people are actually doing it. And I think that as a result of this, because more people are taking it seriously and there is more interest in it generally, I think that's why there needs to be a bit more guidance as to what is, you know, what is a part of this and what isn't. So I think it's, there's been a lot of talk recently of greenwashing. So I think this is, you know, this is the right thing.
Well, I'm as well like a bit cynical as to the fact that big corporations do want to actually save the world as a priority. It doesn't seem like it. It's a movement, it's a trend. So, you know, when this is going to die down, is everything going to go back to normal? I don't think so, because it's just not possible. Obviously, investment is going to go from fossil fuels, oil and gas, to more sustainable, definitely. But I think it's going to be interesting if we can see a algorithm that can actually detect this and have maybe sort of the shades actually numbered. So this is, you know, 20%, 30%, as hard as it is.
But a green algorithm then, basically.
Exactly. So because Article 8 and 9, I will not read them, but they are quite vague. So Article 8, it says environmental and socially promoting investments. That can mean so many things. And it just means that a financial product promotes, among other characteristics, ESG characteristic. What does that mean? Who exactly that has a definition? Article 9 is really the highest threshold, which is for products that target sustainable investment, obviously like renewable energy. But maybe if we can have really like a list, categories, a lot more, you know, data and research about this, I think it might be possible to, you know, down the line, see an algorithm, and then where's going to be the justification?
Very cunning. I think that makes, because you can actually say, well, yes, because it's so complicated, that's why an algorithm is actually needed.
Why leave it to the, you know, subjective, ideas of.
There'll be so after I'll tell you after this, Jasmine, right, there's going to be this if there are any funds managers, ESG fund managers listening to this, they're all going to start crying. And if there are any lawyers listening to this, they'll be rubbing their hands together, because obviously when you have guidance that is not definitive, that's where lawyers make all their money. So there we go. So anyway, interesting. One of those things that's going to run and run, but I thought it is worth flagging though, for sure.
Exactly. So what is your story for today?
So yeah, my story is something. It's basically a joint venture between Société Générale and Alliance Bernstein. Now, before everyone starts switching off again, so I might come across as being really paranoid here, because I think I said this yesterday as well. It's like, oh, this is what I think is really interesting. But hey, everyone, stay here because it is actually interesting. This is interesting because SocGen is basically an investment bank. Alliance Bernstein is, you know, like an asset manager, essentially. And the two are, you would have thought that their philosophies, their way of doing things are different, because SocGen is European and French, and Alliance Bernstein is American. Mm. And, you know, you do get a difference in philosophy, ways of doing things and stuff between American companies and European companies. But also, if you layer on top of that, the difference between what is often referred to as the sell side and the buy side. Mm. So the sell side is generally, this is, you know, there's variations of it, but basically think of the sell side as the side that sells stuff, like, you know, sells ideas, sells stocks, you know, that sort of thing. So that would be investment banks. And then on the buy side, you have the people that buy stuff. So the investment managers, you know, they buy stocks and shares, they buy other assets and things like that in an attempt to make money grow. That's basically it. They made an announcement that there's going to be a joint venture. It's going to be SocGen is in the driving seat. It will own 51% of the new venture, and then obviously Alliance Bernstein will own the other, you know, will own the remainder. Now I just thought it was interesting because this is a joint venture and they've got an option. So SocGen have got an option to buy after 5 years. So because this is the case, it sounds like they will potentially operate quite, you know, as they've always done, and quite separately. Mm. And if that's the case, I think that there is going to be a bit of needle between the two, because, so I'm just saying this because, you know, there's been a couple of times in my career where I've seen this happen myself. So I was working at a stockbroker's called Cazenove that was taken, well, we were in a joint venture, I think it was termed as a joint venture with JP Morgan, but basically they bought us, right? So And at the time we thought, oh, what's going to happen now? Because that's two sell side companies, and we thought, oh, we're going to be in competition with each other. We're going to, like, some of us going to lose our jobs because we're duplicated on the other side. But it didn't happen. It just, you know, we just existed separately. We just happened to be part of a joint venture. Same thing when I was at Mitsubishi. Same kind of deal with Mitsubishi, where to keep it simple, we were kind of in a joint venture type thing with Morgan Stanley. But the thing was, we again operated separately. Morgan Stanley had their sales and trading and research. We had our sales, trading and research, and we never met. You know, there was no cross selling, no nothing. So from that point of view, it may be, so it all sounds all very exciting because, you know, they're two are kind of complementary. So there's not really much overlap. You've got Alliance Bernstein stronger in America, in North America and Asia, and SocGen being stronger in Europe. But on the other hand, you know, there may be some kind of cultural changes or, you know, structural changes that take place over time. But I don't know, what do you make of this situation?
Yeah, relating to, you know, the two business obviously not having much geographic overlap, I think that's good in terms of, you know, obviously minimum job cuts and loss of clients. But that's really on paper, because like you said, that's going to be, you know, a lot of fighting grounds for maybe grabbing the other clients, culture adjustments. So hopefully this doesn't end up in flames and litigation.
No.
But it seems that it's a very good deal. And like I think we talked about it earlier, is that the SocGen salespeople must be very happy about this, because yes. AllianceBernstein has quite a good research team, and they bought Autonomous Research, which was like a separate research group. So definitely aligning the two would be the best of both worlds, but we'll see, because of that option to buy again. This is going to be SocGen's baby after this, in 2028, after 5 years. So we'll see how it's going to adapt, if that deal might change. But yeah, really interesting news, to be honest.
I mean, a lot can happen in 5 years, and as you rightly said, I mean, you know, I would say, selfishly, as an ex-salesperson myself, if I was at SocGen in sales, I'd be loving this, because I'd be thinking, you know, if I could access Bernstein Research, because Bernstein Research is good. It has a good, you know, reputation. And as a salesperson, you always want to sell the best products because it's the easiest one to sell, and you potentially get the most return from it. And just so for people that, you know, who are listening to this, who not quite sure of, you know, the difference between the research, as I was saying, and I might have to do another podcast on this to explain the differences, but so buy side and sell side, on the Bernstein side, they probably have they've got their research department with all these analysts covering all the different sectors, but they get their information from the companies themselves, as does everyone else, and all the reports and things, but they also get a lot of input from analysts from the sell side, like SocGen or Goldman Sachs or Merrill Lynch or all of those. So actually the Bernstein researchers will be sitting there, and they get all this input from all the different investment banks. And I said to you, it's a bit like me with Watson's Daily. Right now, I'm not a journalist, and you know, journalists have a very hard job, right? And yet what I can do is I take all that, what I think are the best bits from all the different, you know, sources that I use. I put them together. I put them, you know, with what I think in there as well. And then, you know, I have something which I think is a good product, which is, you know, Watson's Daily, right? Whereas, and so with same with Bernstein, they can pick all the best bits and pieces, because, you know, there are, like with research analysts, okay, there are some people who, for instance, there were some people that I would go to who are brilliant at knowing the nuts and bolts of what's going on in their industry and the companies. So really, really good. But their recommendations are badly timed and wrong, right? So that's fine, as long as you know what so you go to this person for the real nitty gritty knowledge, and you go to someone else for the trading side of it. And I think that if you could do, you know, I think that with Bernstein analysts, they can do that. They can pick, because they see all of it, they can pick the good stuff and they put it into themselves. Then they have them then overlay it, then they have the really good stuff. Whereas with SocGen analysts, they got to make their own research, they got to do their own models, and basically they live or die by their recommendations. And they have a much broader array of clients. So my point is that's why I would have thought that Bernstein Research is really good. If you could, I think in an ideal world, and this sounds terribly harsh, but if you could have SocGen's sales and trading and Bernstein's research, that would be perfect. And you know, you could, and I think that, for instance, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if Bernstein researchers start doing more kind of European kind of research, and SocGen analysts try, you know, they try. I think there'll be a lot of trying to protect their own kind of areas and things because they don't want to lose their jobs. And so it's going to be an interesting time. But it may be for the moment that no one really you know, it doesn't really change anything on the day to day, but I think over time it will.
A story to follow.
Absolutely. So we better finish there, but, I was also going to say next Wednesday, so week today even, I'm going to do the final monthly recap of the year. So this is for the month of November. Not going to do a wrap in December because I am going to be doing a wrap of the entire year right at the beginning of January. And I'll be doing a wrap of the year and the preview of 2023. So if you are interested, you know, register, it's on our Linktree and stuff. We'll put some more stuff out from now. But yeah, if you are interested, please sign up for that. And, you know, we'll be there for the last one this year. But anyway, yeah. So thank you very much, Jasmine, for your thoughts today.
Thank you so much as well.
No problem. And thank you very much for listeners for listening and spending time with us. We will be back again once more tomorrow. So many thanks. Bye.
Bye.